Ladies and gentlemen, these seats up here at the front have not been reserved. You are welcome to move up. This is the devotional for Saturday. I guess it's session number one, Mike? Session number one of the Western Symposium. My name is Bill Quist. Many of you probably know my wife, Carol. And I'd appreciate if you would still be kind to her, because as we understand, everybody is due forgiveness for at least one major mistake. And I'm hers. At least one of them, if she may have others. All right, now, this session and all sessions, if you have a cell phone, turn it off now, please. Let's see, there's some other things, nice things I'm supposed to tell you. Oh, any other noisemakers? So if you snore in any of the sessions, it's not permitted. Turn that one off. And then, yes, we do have some, there are some book sales, as I think you've all seen out in the hall. I will very much appreciate if you'll buy all the books that Sunstone has here for sale, and then I'll have to haul them home. So if you'd do that, we'd appreciate it. All right. Our speaker for this session is Michael Vinson. He has a 2010 master's graduate from the Divinity School of University of Cambridge. He also has a master's degree from BYU and the University of Chicago. So he has three masters in addition to his wife. And the Sunstone magazine, thank you for coming to the first row. The Sunstone magazine scripture notes are written by Mike Vinson. And 2 years ago, if my memory is correct, and I wasn't here at that time, he gave the devotional here. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That is correct. He's originally from Sacramento, California. I think most of you have heard of that. Grew up in the valley, in Sacramento Valley there, and he now lives in Star Valley, Wyoming. Now, the thing that has made Star Valley, Wyoming famous is that Rulon Gardner, who won the gold medal in the Olympics a few years ago, is from Star Valley, Wyoming. And I think it was 2 years ago he went snowmobiling at home. The snowmobile broke down. He spent the night. And I believe he lost two toes. They froze off. So you are left to wonder sometimes about people who move from Sacramento to Star Valley. But we are still happy to have Mike Vinson with us. And time is yours, Mike.
Thank you.
And I'll sit here and watch for sleepers.
Okay. We do have, you know, Star Valley is a rural place, and there are a lot of farmers there, but we also have a little club we call the Swearing Elders, and we meet in the wintertime and have some really interesting discussions and things. And so you can find thought-provoking things in the most unlikely places. I want to suggest, I retitled my talk one more time in addition to the five other times that I already changed the title and told Mary Ellen. But I want to suggest today that Wrestling Jacob's Angel, How God Helps Us Discover Ourselves. And to take this story, analyze it, and go through it, and really come out on the other side of it, I hope, with a new view of this story, and perhaps for yourselves as well. I want to suggest that how God helped Jacob find his true identity might very well be how he'll help you find your true identity as well in wrestling with this angel. I want to begin by telling an animal fable from the 19th century Hindu saint Sri Ramakrishna that can help us understand this process of self-discovery. I'm not going to relate it to Jacob and the angel right now, but we'll get back to it later. It was collected by Heinrich Zimmer in a book called Philosophies of India. In the story, a newborn tiger cub is abandoned, and some goats find it, and their maternal instincts take over, and these goats come over to the tiger cub, and they raise it up, and they teach it to eat grass and bleat like a goat. And for all intents and purposes, it thinks it's a goat. One day, an old tiger jumps into the herd, attacks it, and the herd flees except for this young tiger. And he's a little self-conscious, he's a little nervous, he doesn't know what to do, so he nibbles some grass. And the old tiger roars, "What are you doing eating grass like a goat?" Oh, he's still a little self-conscious, so he bleats. And the old tiger roars again, "What are you doing bleating like a goat?" And he doesn't know what to say, so the old tiger grabs him by the scruff of the neck, picks him up, and takes him to a pond in the jungle, and forces him to look in the pond. In the pond, he sees that his reflection is almost the same as the old tiger. He doesn't know what to make of this yet, though. And the old tiger asks him, "What do you see in the water? What do you see in the reflection?" And still he doesn't answer. Finally, the old tiger takes him to a kill that he's had, and takes some raw meat, and he shoves it in his throat. The young tiger cub doesn't want to eat the meat, but finally he does. And then, at the first taste of blood, something amazing happens to him. His senses wake up, and he becomes alive. And at that moment, he lets out his first tiger roar. So just keep this story in mind for a minute now. I know we don't traditionally think of spiritual metaphors and tigers. They don't usually go together. We like to talk about lambs and sheep. But just keep this one of tigers in your mind for a minute. Now I'll just read the story through first of Jacob wrestling the angel, and then I'll go on and I have some notes about it. It starts in Genesis 32, verse 24. "And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, 'Let me go, for the day breaketh.' And he said, 'I will not let thee go, except thou bless me.' And he said unto him, 'What is thy name?' And he said, 'Jacob.' And he said, 'Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, for as a prince thou hast power with God and with men, and hast prevailed.' And he said, and Jacob asked him and said, 'Tell me, I pray thee, thy name.' And he said, 'Wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name?' And he blessed him there, and Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." Traditionally, the story of Jacob wrestling the angel has been a difficult one to understand. The explanations given have varied widely in the ancient, medieval, and modern world. And I have a lot of footnotes here that I'm obviously not reading, but if anyone would like a copy of the paper, I brought a few along for afterwards. Martin Luther once said, "Every man holds this text, the story of Jacob and the angel, to be one of the most obscure in the Old Testament." I went looking at what some LDS commentators had said. Hugh Nibley had an interesting idea about Jacob wrestling the angel. He said, "Perhaps we should look at it as a ritual embrace instead of a fight." And this is a quote. "One of the most puzzling episodes in the Bible has always been the story of Jacob's wrestling with the Lord. When one considers that the word conventionally translated by wrestle can just as well mean embrace, and that it was in this ritual embrace that Jacob received a new name, and the bestowal of priestly and kingly power at sunrise, the parallel to the Egyptian coronation embrace becomes at once apparent." While an attractive idea, I think this approach, embrace mistranslated as wrestle, misses the mark. The Hebrew word used for wrestle in these verses is abak, A-B-A-Q. It's a relatively rare word. It only occurs twice, I believe, in the Old Testament, and both times in this story. Now, the Hebrew word for embrace is habak, H-A-B-A-Q. Well, so you can see why Nibley probably wondered if the real word shouldn't be habak instead of abak, which would lead him to a temple interpretation of the incident. But the biblical context around the uses of embrace, or habak, show the standard hallmarks of meetings of loved ones. For example, it's used in Genesis 29:13 when Laban comes out to meet his nephew Jacob and he embraces and kisses him. But in Jacob's encounter with the angel, there's no kiss, and Jacob doesn't even know who his opponent is. And as far as a ritual embrace, how many temple ceremonies end with having your hip dislocated? What about the fighter wrestling match then? Even though the word wrestle, abak, has no other uses that we can point to for a context, which is really the best way to understand words, there are a couple of other clues to help us. First, the word wrestle probably shares a close root with dust. Both are spelled nearly the same, ABAQ for dust, ABAQ for wrestle, with a couple of vowel accents for the differences between the two. So both dust and wrestle are spelled abak. So the connotation of dirt and fighting on the ground, as in wrestling, leads us to believe that this might be a more correct interpretation. So then, did Jacob wrestle a man or an angel? While we don't know who Jacob thought attacked him in the night, we can speculate that perhaps he thought at first his opponent was an advanced scout. His brother Esau is coming from the south side of the river to meet him. And he might have thought it was an advanced scout from his brother Esau. He's returning at this point with Rachel and his family from Laban, coming back to the land where he was raised. But some good support for the identification of an angel comes from Hosea 12:3-4, where Hosea preaches on Jacob and the angel. And it says there, "He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God. Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spake with us." The Hebrew word that Hosea uses in verse 4 to describe the angel is malak, M-A-L-A-K. Now, this word carries the meaning of either a human or a supernatural messenger. The context of the story generally gives the key as to whether the messenger is human or not. The same term is used to describe those occasions when an encounter with a malak leads the visitants to say they have seen God, as Jacob did after receiving his blessing. "I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." So we are a little more certain now that Jacob probably wrestled a heavenly messenger. It was not a ritual embrace, nor was it just a man who wanted to keep him from crossing the river. Now let's confront the thornier question. Why did he have to wrestle this man at the river? I want to take a minute now and just look at the larger context of Jacob's life, which usually isn't done in this instance. There was one general authority a few years ago that wrote a question and answer book about the gospel. And one of the questions in there was, did Jacob wrestle an angel? And he said, certainly not. It's just, you know, doesn't make any sense that that a man could overpower an angel. But I want to think about this a little differently now and keep in mind what we've read here and perhaps what the person writing this book may not have been aware of in the uses of the words and what they actually mean. Jacob has a probably well-deserved reputation as a crafty fellow. He buys the birthright from his elder brother, then he tricks his father into recognizing it and giving him the blessing. And finally, after he's married his two wives, he tricks his uncle Laban in so that he ends up with the better part of the flocks. So all through his life, he's sort of a guy who's looking for the advantage in everything that he does. He's looking out for himself. Even the folk etymology of his name, which isn't a very accurate way to depict word definitions, but it's interesting to see here because it means heel sneak. That's what the root of his name is derived from. Jacob comes from that. In this story, as you're all aware, as he's raised up, I'm going to go through each of the three things that he's done. Isaac loves Esau, but Rebekah, their mother, favors Jacob. Jacob's a farmer, but Esau was a hunter. Esau returns from the hunt one day and asks his brother for some pottage because he was faint. Jacob replies, "Sell me this day thy birthright." Esau replies, "I am at the point to die, and what profit shall this birthright do me?" Jacob has him swear to the deal and then feeds his brother. This is quite a deal for Jacob, since the birthright not only gives the bearer more prestige, but it gives you 2/3 of the inheritance. So it's like doubling your inheritance right away by getting the birthright. This is the traditional interpretation of the story. Consider the following view just for a minute, though. Let your minds wander for a second. Esau's been out hunting, and he comes up to Jacob's tent. He smells something good cooking. We don't know what it is. It says pottage in the King James Version, but it's not pottage. The word is adom, A-D-O-M. In Hebrew, it means red. So it's some kind of a word that means red. It was some good food that they called red. Big red, who knows? But whatever that food was, it was red. And he sees or smells the red there, and he's like, "Give me some of the red that you've got there." Imagine someone 2,000 years from now trying to translate hot dog. And they'll say, "Oh yeah, dog, we know exactly what that is. We've got millions of references to dogs. And hot, we know what hot is. It's the opposite of cold." And you can see where that would take you in the wrong place right away for a translation there. But anyway, whatever this stuff is, it's called red. Now imagine the story a little more like this. Esau walks up, "Oh, I'm glad you're cooking something. Feed me, I'm starving." And Jacob's like, "All right, but first sell me your birthright." He's like, maybe he thinks Jacob's horse playing. After all, the traditional bounds of Jewish custom would dictate that you would offer food to a stranger who comes up to your tent, how much more so to your brother. But he says, you want my birthright. All right, take it. I'm about to die. Jacob says, you have to swear it first. Fine, Esau says. I swear it. Now feed me. Think about the story in that context, where Esau perhaps thinks that, you know, he's playing along in this horseplay with his brother, but Jacob wants to hold him to it. Whether the selling of the birthright was a case of exaggerated banter or an actual transaction, Isaac certainly would not recognize this transaction. He still has to trick his father. And that leads us to believe that it's not a real transaction. At least it's not recognized by anyone else. Though Esau is aware that Jacob believes he has purchased it, or becomes aware at some point after that, Jacob goes around telling people that he's purchased the birthright. So for Jacob to achieve the blessing and the birthright, he must now trick his father with the help of his mother. Rebekah hears Isaac tell Esau to fetch some venison, and then he'll give him the blessing. She tells Jacob about this and says she'll cook 2 kids from the flock for Isaac so he can sneak in and claim the birthright. But Jacob says, wait, he's going to feel my hands, he's not going to recognize me. And she says, fine, we'll tie some goat skins around your hands so he'll think that it's Esau. So Rebekah dresses Jacob in Esau's best clothes, and Jacob tricks his father into giving him the blessing. And later we have Esau's pleading to his father, hast thou not reserved a blessing for me? Even though Isaac confirms that he has been deceived into giving the blessing to Jacob, the birthright is of no practical use to Jacob, because Esau now swears that as soon as his father dies, he's going to kill Jacob, and the birthright will be of no use to him whatsoever. So Rebekah says, listen, she tells Isaac, why don't you send, it's time for Jacob to get married, send him off to Haran, which is in Mesopotamia, and my brother lives there, and he has a daughter, and he can marry her. So Jacob goes to Haran, falls head over heels for Rachel, but now it's Jacob's turn to be tricked when Laban substitutes his older daughter, Leah, for Rachel on the wedding day. Jacob ends up working 14 years for his uncle Laban in order to secure Rachel's hand, after which he wants to establish his own household. So he makes a deal with Laban, and he says, listen, the less desirable animals are going to be the ones that have spotted and streaked goats and the dark-colored lambs. Nobody wants the marked animals like that. He says, let me have the marked animals, and then, you know, you keep the rest of the flock, and whatever the marked animals are, those will be mine. And Laban says, fine, it sounds like a fair trade because marked animals are relatively unusual. But in the story, Jacob goes out and strips the bark off to make stripes. And anciently they believed that if an animal was about to breed and they saw stripes, then they'd have a striped goat, you know, or a spotted goat. And so in this way, he manages to accumulate this vast herd of spotted and streaked and darked animals. And Laban eventually becomes jealous. Probably his other sons are like, why is he taking the better part of your herds, father? So Jacob decides to flee with his flocks and his family, but Laban comes after him. After a reconciliation, Laban and Jacob erect a pillar of stones as a covenant that neither shall cross the boundary line after the other. So in effect, this also means that Jacob can never go back there. He's got to continue going forward. He's going back to his homeland. Now, as Jacob heads back with his kingdom in tow, he hears that Esau is coming with 400 men to meet him. To the ancient listeners of this story, 400 men is a number that denotes the same number as a military cohort. And it would become evident to the ancient listeners of the story that Esau was coming to punish Jacob. He's going to give it to him now. After all these years of putting up with his stuff, when he's returning home, he's bringing a military cohort out to give it to him. But the ever-crafty Jacob comes up with another plan. First, he divides his camp into two parts, so that if one part's attacked, the other part can escape. And then, he devises a plan to appease Esau's anger with large gifts of flocks and herds as the army approaches. Finally, almost as an afterthought, he prays to God for assistance and deliverance from the wrath of Esau. This brings us up to the night when Jacob wrestles the heavenly messenger. Some commentaries have wondered if this passage about the crossing of the river at night preserves an accurate textual tradition. But I can easily imagine a sleepless Jacob lying in bed, wondering how close Esau and his 400 men are, worrying about what would happen if they arrive at the river, they're about to cross the river Jabbok here, before Jacob sends the gift flocks over. Jacob rises at once and rouses the entire camp, insisting that everyone, family, herdsmen, and flocks, must cross the river now in the middle of the night. You can, I don't know if you've ever tried to move animals or not, but you can imagine trying to move all these goats and sheep across the river in the middle of the night. It must have taken hours, and it must have been a mess. But now that everyone has crossed, I imagine Jacob doing a final check on the far side of the bank. He's by himself at this point, walking around looking for forgotten items or lost animals. Then as he heads to the river to cross for the last time, the heavenly messenger stops him, and the longest night of Jacob's life begins. He is alone. His family, servants, and herds are across the river. No one is looking for him. What if Esau reached his family and slaughtered them before Jacob could intercede? The stakes were high enough that Jacob exerted himself till dawn of the next morning. Jacob the wily, Jacob the successful, will be Jacob the limp leg the next morning, but he will also be someone else. I would like to suggest that Jacob thought this struggle was about crossing the river, but that God had something else in mind, that he used this struggle to help Jacob find his true identity. What if the messenger is sent to help Jacob find out who he really is? Jacob has to wage a mighty struggle, and at the end he is still left with a permanent crippling injury, but also a new name and a blessing. A parallel for our lives might be heavenly messengers that come in the form of sicknesses, accidents, and other trials that we would rather do without, and that in many cases leave us with a permanent mark or injury. I do not suggest this lightly, as someone who has never endured real suffering might, but I think I speak with my voice of experience, even though it is not your experience, and I do not claim to speak for your trials. My wrestling began with a strong premonition. In the spring of 2001, I accidentally arrived a half hour early to a stake priesthood meeting. I decided to use the time to meditate and pray, and in my meditation I asked, "Is there anything you want to tell me?" An answer came into my mind immediately, not a voice, but just as clear, "You're going to die." I was shaken, but I asked, "When?" Just as clearly again came the answer, "The next summer." I managed to put the premonition out of my head for a while, but as the next summer drew closer, I began to make sure that I obeyed the speed limits more carefully and fastened my seatbelt every time I got into the car. But at the end of July, I was diagnosed in the following year with an advanced case of cancer in two stages. Oh, two tumors, rather. I had to undergo an extremely intensive regimen of chemotherapy, receiving as much chemo in 3 months as is usually given over a year. In fact, I've had my lifetime allotment of chemo, and I've been told by my doctors that I cannot receive any further treatments. Near the end of the treatments, my prognosis did not look good. The largest tumor was not shrinking. In my meditations this time, another voice came to me. "There are two ways that this can go," it said. "You can either come here, the spirit world, where there are many things you can do, or you can stay in life, where there is also much good you can do." It was clear that the decision was mine. Almost instantly, I said, "I choose life." Didn't even have to think twice about it. And I began to improve. But I was not done wrestling the angel. Within 2 weeks of my final treatment, I received a phone call from the Department of Justice, the Attorney General's office in New York City, in connection with the price fixing of buyer's premiums at leading New York auction houses. I told them I would be happy to tell them anything I knew. This is in connection with my rare book business. "But I had nothing to hide," I said. "Just come and interview me. I'll tell you everything I know." But they only said, "Mr. Vinson, you don't understand. I can't stress to you enough how much you need to get an attorney, because you are going to prison." They didn't want to listen to me. They only wanted to intimidate and scare me. And it worked. It worked really well. So well that as Christmas approached, I broke out in a terrible case of hives and was unable to sleep at night. I worried about my rare book business and how I would provide for my family if I were in prison. Later, the case turned out to be unfounded and was completely dismissed, with no charges or indictments ever brought against me. But I still wasn't finished wrestling the angel. On Christmas Day, after our dinner and everyone was hanging around the house, I found out that the fire sprinkler pipes in my rare book office had burst, and my entire inventory of rare books and manuscripts was completely soaked. When I arrived at my office, I couldn't speak. I was so shocked. I could only shake my head in disbelief. Remember Matthew 25? "Lord, when saw we thee in prison, or hungry and naked or sick?" That was me all at once. Did I mention that the heavenly messenger is a dirty fighter? That angel still has, I had testicular cancer, and that angel still has one of my balls. In the midst of all of this suffering, I began to forge a new identity. I embraced my life with a new passion and a determination to follow my new course, which ultimately included traveling to Greece and Turkey to explore New Testament locations, getting a master's from the Divinity School at the University of Cambridge, writing my scripture notes column for Sunstone. And who knows what's next in this adventure that I'm following. But I'm happier now than I've ever been in my life, and I'm also filled with more compassion and love and understanding. I would like to suggest another way of viewing these trials analogous to what Jacob did after his struggle. He embraced the angel and hung on with his might, determined to get a blessing out of that struggle. He still has his scar because now he limps, but there is a blessing too. It's interesting to note that Hosea 12:4 preserves a side of Jacob's character not found elsewhere. Instead of the brash, arrogant, crafty, tricky man demanding a blessing, we see that Jacob wept and supplicated the angel after his struggle. This vision of crying and pleading reveals more of the inner character of Jacob and gives us a clue to the transformation of his identity from Jacob to Israel. Later in life, when Jacob Israel is recounting the incident of the angelic visitation to his grandsons, Ephraim and Manasseh, he tells them about the angel who has redeemed me from all harm and evil. Right after receiving his angelic blessing, Jacob sees Esau with his 400 men coming. But Jacob is now Israel, a new man. He doesn't care about his crafty plan to appease Esau anymore. Israel still worries that his family might be attacked, and he prepares them, but then he walks out ahead of everyone and begins bowing down as Esau approaches. When Esau sees his brother, he runs to meet him, embraces and kisses him, and they wept. Israel has a new vision and sees the world in a new way. When he looks at his brother after the embrace, he sees the divine presence there and says to him, "Seeing your face, Esau, is like seeing the face of God." This is a clue to us on how he was transformed. I would like to read something by Joseph Campbell, a world scholar of mythology. I know we're close on time here, but we're almost done. I'm on the last page. Campbell said this about struggles and trials. "Nietzsche was the one who did the job for me. At a certain moment in his life, the idea came to him of what he called the love of your fate. Whatever your fate is, whatever the hell happens, you say, 'This is what I need. It may look like a wreck, but go at it as though it were an opportunity, a challenge. If you bring love to that moment, not discouragement, you will find the strength in there. Any disaster you can survive is an improvement in your character, your stature, and your life. What a privilege. I know that heavenly messengers do not look like a privilege when you meet them. They are fierce obstructors and destroyers. For Jacob, the heavenly messenger literally kept him from rejoining his family and getting to the other side of the river. We may beg God to call the angel off, but we may, if we will, see the trial as a revelation from God. We might be uncomfortable with the idea of a fierce but loving God, but consider this, this is what C.S. Lewis taught us as well, that God is good but not safe. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Susan asks Mr. Beaver if Aslan is a man. Mr. Beaver replies, "Aslan a man? Certainly not. Don't you know who is the king of beasts? Aslan is the great lion." "Oh," says Susan, "I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe?" "Safe," said Mr. Beaver. "Who said anything about being safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you." I don't mean to terrify you, because your angel may not be a sickness or a trial. It may come in another form. But remember the fable from India about the roar of awakening? That's the name of that story that I told you, that the little tiger realizes who he is. The point of the story is not that tigers should take advantage of weaker creatures such as goats. It is that in the uncomfortable and painful process of self-discovery, you will find your true nature.